morning to everybody. We are looking today at Numbers chapter 7. And I want to ask a question. Where did we end last week? I'm not asking because I don't know. I'm asking because I fear you don't know. Where did we end last week? Did you go to the 8 o'clock worship service?
Yes.
Did you watch how the Friends of the Groom ended our service? Did you hear an echo of what we tried to do last week? They did this week much better what I tried to help you do last week. Those of you who haven't been to church yet, I hope you will be there, and I hope that they will do something very similar to what they did in our hour. Number 7, you don't get to do, because we've done it already, we've done it recently, we've talked about it a while. I will point out two things for you. Number 1, how many verses? Starts with L.
Lots.
There are very few chapters in the Bible that have more verses than this one. Okay? Please take a look, starting at verse 10, starting at verse 12. What are the first three or four words?
The leaders offered the dedication.
I'm hoping that you're not looking at verse 12. Verse 12. Okay. How does verse 12 start? I'm hoping it starts the same way it does in mine. Mine starts on the first day. Does yours have something like that somewhere close by? Look for that same place in verse 18. Verse 24. Verse 30. Verse 36. And so forth. How many days? 12 days, and other than the name of the person and the tribe and family that that person represents, those 6 verses are identical. Bill Rosenblum calls this the king of the boring parts. And it is anything but. Did you go to the 8 o'clock service?
Yes.
Did you hear the story of the three trees?
Yes.
The cross on which our Lord was crucified was not dedicated for its purpose. It is my belief it was dedicated in number 7. Because what happens in number 7 is an Old Testament preview of what happens as a result of the cross. There is an initial 8 or 9 verses in chapter 7 where they dedicate all the other things that have been built. And then the rest, almost 70 verses, is spent dedicating the altar, the place where the sacrifice was made. And at the end of all of that, the last verse of the chapter, what you find is that when that is done, a channel of communication is open where people can hear God clearly and understand who He is and what He's saying. On the surface, it looks like the king of the boring parts. As a matter of fact, it's one of the highlights in the whole of the Old Testament. Now, we've already talked in detail about that. That was on another day. So we're not going to talk again about it in detail today. So now let me take you back to last week. How much theological significance, how much uplifting and directive information was provided in chapter 1 of Numbers? Starts with it. Not much. How about chapter 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 and 6? Not much. And when you come to chapter 7, the pattern seems to be set and you think you're not seeing much, but you are. Numbers has a way of doing that. It sneaks up on you. The high points get hidden by other things because they're both telling you a story and fitting in things that are important in a much bigger story across the whole of the Bible. So, with a little bit of fear and a lot of trembling, I have a question. You have read the book of Numbers, right? What are the high points? I'll give you the first one. It's number 7. What are the high points?
Chapters 8 and 9.
If you walk through the book of Numbers, I see 12 high points. Okay, I actually see 13, but 13's a bad number, so I'm going to put the last two together and just call it 12A and 12B.
13's a good number.
13 high points. Some of those are not an entire verse, they're a fraction of a verse. But the power that comes from that, physicists would call it a point source, is very important. Other places, it's several chapters. So my challenge is, because it does look like you came to class today unprepared, go through and make a list. Read Numbers, but read it for, is there something here that speaks to the life that Christians are trying to live today? And if there are, write them down. See what your list is. My intention is to work a little bit today and then begin to get into the next ones of these. As we get to them, I'll let you know what they are, at least the ones that I found. But we'll see. I will give you a clue. The next one that I found beyond number 7 wasn't numbers 8. So let's take a look at numbers 8. We are trying to walk through this in order. Numbers 8, there's a lot more about the Levites. You could almost call this Leviticus B if you wanted to.
Well, what about the first 4 verses? I mean, God is speaking to Moses. I was thinking he was speaking to all the people.
That's the only thing I get out of the first four verses that really speaks to the larger story that the Bible's trying to tell, is the fact that the lampstands are echoed in Revelation. But I don't. There are places in here where the echo is strong and clear. I don't think this is one of them. But you do learn things about what the Levites are supposed to do and something of the way they're supposed to do it. And that prepares the ground. That prepares a background against which things can work. I do want you to notice that if you look at verse 17, 18, 19, you might see again what we saw in an earlier chapter, which is a reminder that the Levites have a very specific function. Let me try once again. I was told by someone who's very important to me that I didn't do this quite as successfully as I might have thought last week. So let's try one more time. How many tribes are there? 12. Thank you. The Levites are taken out of the count of tribes and given a place of their own, so they are not counted with the tribes. You saw that in the census that was taken, right? So with the Levites removed, how many tribes are there?
12.
How does that work? If the Levites are included, there are 12 tribes and Joseph counts once. If the Levites are removed, there are 12 tribes because Joseph counts twice. Anytime the Levites are out, you don't see Joseph, you see Manasseh and Ephraim. Whenever the Levites are in, you see Joseph, you don't see Manasseh and Ephraim. Joseph gets a double portion when the land is distributed, when other kinds of things are doing. And Manasseh and Ephraim, sometimes later in the Bible, called half-tribes. Okay? So there's something special about the Levites. The Levites are set aside for service in the temple. Out of the Levites is the family of Aaron. Their special service is? They are to be the priests. Okay? And so this chapter talks about that. And what God has said in a previous chapter and reaffirms here is that He is viewing the Levites as a substitute for the firstborn of Israel, that out of the 12 tribes, the firstborn was to be uniquely his. He is taking the Levites instead of that group. It's a substitution. So you see an echo in there. Verse 17, for all the firstborn of Israelites, whether man or beast, do indeed belong to me. The day I struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, I consecrated them to myself, and now in place of all the firstborn of Israelites, I have taken the Levites. That's an echo, a reminder of that. There is in this chapter, if you look at the right place, those of you who want to look in the right place might look at verse 24. It tells you the term of service. You may remember when you were doing the census, it was over the age of 20, I think it was, and able to bear arms. And then when you counted the Levites, it was counted from 1 month old and sort of forever. What's the term of service for the Levites? From age 25 to... It's not just upward. It's to 50, right? Age 25 to 50, right? So age 20 to can't bear arms anymore was one way of looking at it for the Levites. So how long do you work before you go to retirement? 25 years. Had a conversation with my friend this morning. I'm considering the fact that this class has been going for almost 22 years now, and I'm wondering how many of you were working when the class started and how many of you are retired now. I think the proportion is better than 50% are now retired, because it's been close to 25 years, and by the time you go 25 years, you're probably close to retirement, right? Some of us are still slaving away, some of us are still loafing away. Take a choice of how you do this. I understand your attitude. Okay, but that's an interesting... Now, what happens, verse 25, after the age of 50? Mine starts out, in fact, that verse starts out after the age of 50. They are no longer he, they're talking about an individual. He, the Levite who's over the age of 50, is no longer bound to the ministry. He will have, mine says, no further duties. But he will still help his brothers to assure the services in the tent of meeting, though he himself will no longer have any ministry. What happens in less than a month? Paul Honaker is retired. What happens after he retires? I heard what you said. You might be right. What happens with Paul? Paul is no longer bound to the ministry. He will have no further duties. But he will help his brothers. His brothers consist of other ministers of music, probably, to assure the services, though he himself will no longer have any ministry himself. Now, it turns out for people who have a calling like that, sometimes they will find interim positions and do things like that. But there's a transition. They say 25 to 50. In those days, 50 might have been pretty old. 50 is the new, what, 21? Is that what I heard somebody say one time? Okay, chapter 9, they celebrate the Passover. If they celebrate the Passover, how long has it been since they came out of Egypt? Some multiple of years. Turns out it says it's been 2 years. This is chapter 9, verse 1. It's the second year after the Exodus from Egypt. So they're going to keep the Passover. They are now remembering what happened, in their case, 2 years before. They also prepare to move. And it says in verse 15 and following, verse 17, whenever the cloud rose from the tent, the Israelites broke camp, and wherever the cloud halted, there the Israelites pitched camp. You've seen in an earlier chapter, there's an orderliness to how people are arranged around the center. And if you take a look at chapter 10, verse 11, something happens. What happens in chapter 10, verse 11? The cloud begins to move. If the cloud begins to move, what do? They begin to move, and they begin to describe that. Is there anything of deep theological significance so far? Starts with N?
No.
Not much. Don't ever say no, because we might find something later. Okay? Chapter 10, verse 28, such was the order of march for the Israelites, unit by unit, and off they went. Mine actually says, so they set out. Verse 29, Moses said to Hobab, son of Reuel, the Midianite, his father-in-law, we are setting out for the country of which the Lord has said, I will give it to you. Come with us, and we will treat you well. Hobab replies, I will not come with you. I will go to my own country and kin. It sounds like Hobab is away from home. He's going to go back to his own kin. Do not leave us, Moses says, for you know where we can camp in the desert, and so you will be our eyes. If you come with us, we will share with you whatever blessings the Lord gives us. So, did Hobab go or did he not go with the people? It doesn't say. Isn't that interesting? I would assume they could have said, I assume he either did or didn't. But as far as I can tell, the Bible is silent on that. Verse 33, they set out. How far did they go?
3 days.
Do you remember, if you did, the first time you ever took your children camping? We went to J.C. Penney's. We bought a tent and some sleeping bags. We went to Pocahontas State Park. I can remember it very well because I remember what my little boy said to me after supper. At the time he was, I don't know, 2, something like that, maybe 3. He looks at me and with a smile he says, Daddy, I got tick up my nose. I said, what? And he said, Daddy, I got tick up my nose. Now, if you had a little boy who said to you, I got a tick up my nose, what would you do? I would look up his nose and see if you could. I look up his nose and I see something dark, because of course I also had a flashlight I'd bought at Penny's. I see something dark and I looked at him and said, do you mean you have a stick up your nose? He said, yeah. I took another look. And I said, take a deep breath. And he took a deep breath. And I went to him. He looks frightened for a moment or two after I cover up one nostril in his mouth. But he's got a deep breath and it's got to go somewhere. And he blew the stick out of his nose. And we didn't have to go to the emergency. I remember the first time I went camping. It was overnight at Pocahontas State Park. All kinds of things could go wrong. You don't want to be far from home. Have you seen the ad for the new Google tablet? It's just come out. I saw it last night during the Olympics. And it was an amazing, amazing thing. It shows this tender picture of a father with a child. And everything they show you, it looks like they're out in the deep woods. But everywhere they go, they've got this tablet with them. It's a compass showing them where to go. It's a planetarium showing them how to read the stars in the sky. It identifies the plants that they're seeing. It's a wonderful tablet. I'm sitting there thinking, isn't this thing going to run out of power sometime soon? But it's just wonderful. And finally, right at the end, on the tablet, they go to Google Earth and they come down to the home that they left behind. And the camera pulls back and you see the house 26 feet away. Okay? How far do you go the first time you go camping? This, all that's happened before has sort of been happenstance and accident. Now they're getting organized. How far do they go? They go 3 days. Far enough that you have to pick up everything and move it to where you can't go back and get something that you've left behind. But not very far. They go 3 days. Okay. And that's the end of verse 10, of chapter 10, right? What's missing from this story? That you would almost, given the nature of the people involved, what's missing from this story? Look at the first verse of chapter 11. What's missing from the story? The griping. It's dirty. A leaf fell in my supper. The people began to complain. What's God's response? First verse, what's his response? Not second verse, not third verse, not fourth verse. Anger. Yours uses the word anger in verse 1.
God heard.
Mine uses the word offensive. The people began to complain, which was offensive to the Lord's ear. And then it says, when the Lord heard, his anger was aroused. And something else happened.
Fire.
The fire of the Lord broke out. And mine says it devoured part of the camp. I don't know what that means. Except it sounds like somebody, at least some of their materials, possessions were destroyed. And maybe some people were hurt or died.
Does it consume some of the outskirts?
Devoured one end of the camp is what mine says. Doesn't say which end. The people appealed to Moses. Moses interceded with the Lord. The fire died down. And they gave a name to the place because God's fire broke out. I don't know how to read this, but I will tell you that when it comes to all of this, God's anger being aroused is one of the big things in this chapter. I don't know what to make of it. I wish I did. I wish I could give you some information that would help you make sense of this. We serve a loving God, but we also serve a God who has standards, and whose standards, if violated, cause problems. The interpretation in those days seems to have been this, and I don't know how to read it. When I read those words seem to me to be out of character with God as he seems to have revealed himself. But I want to be real careful to say I don't know enough to go any further than to say there seem to be big consequences for people who began to follow God and then began to complain about it, began to offer alternatives or to rebel. I'll simply leave that up there. Now, I want you to look at the first phrase of verse 4, because I find this to be a very strange and puzzling phrase, and I want to know if you see it too. Here's the phrase in my translation. Verse 3, the place was called Taberah because the fire of the Lord had broken out among them. End of verse 3. Verse 4, the rabble who had joined the people were feeling the pangs of hunger, and the Israelites began to weep again. That first phrase, does yours have anything like that?
Yes.
Does it use the word rabble?
Yes.
Who is that?
The
rabble who had joined the people were feeling pangs of hunger, and the Israelites began to weep again. He seems to be speaking of two different groups. Okay? Can I take a time out for a minute? Two groups? I thought one group came out of Egypt. I thought it was the children of Israel. I thought that was one group. Isn't that your picture? You got the tribe of this over there. You got the tribe of that over there. Sometimes you have two tribes for Joseph. Sometimes you have one. Depends on how you need to count by the Levites. Right? These are all Israelites. Who's this other group? There's somebody else there. Okay? Now, before we question who this could be, I want to ask you, has this ever happened in Scripture at any other place where you think you know who the group is that's going along and suddenly you find out there's more there? Say yes.
Yes.
Been to the worship service this morning?
Yes.
Expensive ointment, perfume, poured on Jesus' feet and washed off by somebody's hair. Who owned the hair?
Mary.
Mary. Who was Mary? Sister of Martha, sister of Lazarus. 6 days before the Passover and just about that many days before Jesus is going to be crucified. Right? Had that ever happened before in Scripture?
Yeah.
You bet. When did it happen? There was a dinner at a Pharisee's house. And the rules of the day, the culture of the day, seemed to allow people who weren't part of the household to come and watch as long as they didn't speak. I've heard the word kibitz for that. You're not allowed to kibitz, but you are allowed to watch. And a woman came in who was probably a prostitute. And during the dinner, she poured some expensive ointment on Jesus' feet after she had dropped her tears on his feet and tried to dry them off with her hair. Do you remember that? I spend most of a lesson on that. Come to think of it, I have spent most of a lesson on that. But how does that end? Jesus says something powerful to her. What does he say? Do you remember? Go in peace. That's what he says. He doesn't even say there and sin no more. All he says is go in peace. Paul's brother-in-law, David Fisher, was here at the church one time. He spent several Wednesday nights talking about the book of Luke and the parables that are there, the stories that are there. And he talked about this one. And he asked a question that haunts me to this day. You might be finding Luke while you're listening to this. Jesus says, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Where could she go? Have you had that thought before? Where could she go? And then David Fisher gave me a gift that I appreciate to this day. The gift was, read the next five verses. This is Luke 7, verse 50. Tail end of that verse, Jesus said to the woman, your faith has saved you. Go in peace. Chapter 8, verse 1. It happened that after this, he, that's Jesus, made his way through towns and villages, preaching and proclaiming the good news of the kingdom. Period. New sentence. With him were, who?
The twelve.
New verse. As well as certain women who had been cured of evil spirits and ailments. Mary, surnamed the Magdalene, from whom seven demons had gone out. Joanna, the wife of Herod's steward Chuza. Susanna, and many others who provided for them out of their own resources. When Jesus was traveling around in the New Testament days, in the story of Jesus, who was with him? We think it was the 12, right? Who was with him? The 12 and some women who were providing resources to help them out. When he said, go in peace, what's Dr. Luke trying to tell you? She joined the women who were following Jesus. That's the other place in Scripture where I think there's a hint that more's going on than we've ever seen. So let's go back to Numbers. Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11. I am reading a lot into this. I have no idea if I'm right, but I think I might be. The rabble who had joined the people were feeling the pangs of hunger, and the Israelites began to weep again. If you saw 500,000 slaves suddenly walking out of the place of slavery, and you were a slave alongside of them, do you think you might get up and go with them? I think I might too. And if you were a slave in that place, the chances were you were from anywhere. There would have been not an organized group like the children of Israel were. They had somehow maintained an identity through this. There would have been just slaves from everywhere, just all kind of a mishmash of people. And my bet is that's who they're talking about. How many times in Leviticus and so far in Numbers have you seen God saying, and treat the foreigner who is among you with care and with caution? He was saying that, I think, because there were foreigners among them that needed to be treated with care and caution. The rabble who had joined the people were feeling the pangs of hunger, and the Israelites began to weep again. Now, what are they weeping about this time? They have no meat, right? So what do they list that they wish they had? No. What do they list that they wish they had? They list fish, and they list fruit, and they list vegetables, and I think they may even list seeds. How much meat do they list? None. Not a bit, other than maybe the fish.
My Bible references back to Exodus
12:38, which uses that same term, said that people are probably a Jew. The mixed multiple, they call them mixed multiple.
Exodus 12?
Yeah.
I'll look at that afterwards. I don't have a reference to that.
I have a note that just says a non-Israelite mixed group.
I think, if you saw 500,000 slaves walking out, you might walk out with them.
Yeah. Didn't they have lambs and goats and animals with them, but they used for these sacrifices? Were they not allowed to slaughter those with food?
I don't think you should look at the complaints as making sense. I think they had some food that came from them. But I think there had been enough encumbrance of things they had to do. As I said earlier in another place, I think there's a hint that the only time you got to eat meat was when there was a sacrifice. And it was if you look at the way it's worded, it's not perfectly laid out, but it seems like it's indicating the only way to eat meat was to sacrifice an animal and call your friends to come and eat it with you. You couldn't just, I'm going to have steak tonight and who cares what you're having. The only way to have meat was to feed the Levites and to feed your brothers. And so I don't suggest that the complaint necessarily would make sense. But I do note that what they mention is fish. And I notice it says, think of the fish we used to eat free in Egypt. I don't think, how many people go fishing for fun? You all go fishing for fun?
Yeah.
The fish are free, right? How much did it cost you before you get that line in the water? How much did it cost you by the time you've taken the line out of the water with fish on the end of the hook? The fish may be free, but it's not without cost.
They were slaves. How could they go fishing?
Well, maybe they had to go fishing as well as... We are now withering away. There is nothing. Wherever we look, there is nothing except this manna. What did the word manna mean? I think enough of you are here that know. What is this stuff? That's the word manna means. What is this stuff? Now, this is the place where they describe it and describe how they cooked it. Moses heard the people weeping. Verse 10, the Lord's anger was greatly aroused. This is one of the many places. I told you point 11 in my list of sort of highlights. This one's just all over the place. Moses, too, found it disgraceful. The Lord's anger was greatly aroused. Moses, too, found it disgraceful. And he said to the Lord, "Why do you treat your servant so badly? In what respect have I failed to win your favor for you to lay the burden of all these people on me?" Now, let me make sure you see this, because I'd like you to smile at this moment. What have the people done? They have complained. They have griped. Right? Moses doesn't like it. So what does he do? He gripes. I just want to make sure that you have reason to smile here. Okay? Was it I who conceived all these people? Was I their father for you to say to me, "Carry them in your arms like a foster father carrying an unweaned child to the country which I swore to their fathers"? Where am I supposed to find meat to give all these people, pestering me with their tears and saying, "Give me meat to eat"? I cannot carry all these people on my own. The weight is too much for me. If this is how you mean to treat me, please kill me outright. If only I could win your favor and be spared the sight of your misery. I want you to notice as you go by. I don't consider this one of the highlights of this section, but I did want you to notice. God gets mad, and Moses says, wait a minute. You're God of mercy. You're God of forgiveness. You need to forgive these people and work with us. God gets mad and says, "I'm going to just kill them all and start over with you." He does that two or three times in this book and has done that before. And Moses said, no. You've made promises to these people. You need to honor those. There's time that Moses says, "Why don't you just kill me and take me out of all this stuff?" And what does God do? God calms him down. I don't understand this. But I do notice I go by. There seems to be some kind of polarity here. That when God gets mad, Moses then is stepping in to say, "Wait a minute, let's work back to where we need to be." And when Moses gets mad, God steps in. And I find that fascinating. I don't know what to do with it, but I find it fascinating.
Well, it's interesting. They're getting food. They're getting manna. They just want what they had in Egypt.
They are getting nutrition. They are not getting taste.
Bill, I'd like to make a more practical viewpoint.
Yes,
they're on the move. How the heck do they grow anything? They're in the desert. You know, you're in an area that really doesn't have much sustainability.
There is no water for fish, and there are no farms for melon. Right?
Right.
Yeah. The idea of what they want is preposterous. And as you pointed out, they do have some food with them. I think you should prepare yourself to think the food that they have with them is the food for the future and not the food for today. I don't know how far to go with that idea, but I do think that idea is right. So, here's Moses. Why don't you just kill me outright? And what does God come in behind? Because this now approaches a high point. What does God say? This is verse 16 of chapter 11. Collect me. That's my translation. What does yours say there?
Gather,
break. I like collect. Gather is a pretty good word. How many?
Seven.
Who?
Elders.
Of?
Israel.
Foreigners don't get a representation in this part. Collect me 70 of the elders of Israel, men you know to be the people's elders and scribes. Bring them to the tent of meeting and let them stand beside you there. I will come down and talk to you there, and I will take some of the spirit which is on you and put it on them. Then they will bear the burden of the people with you, and you will no longer have to bear it on your own. There is a way a Christian community should function. No leader should bear all the weight alone. The people should bear some of that who are working with that leader. And a leader is foolish who does not recognize that and work to make that happen. I should get my sign for that one, because I think we have foolish leaders around in churches in our country. Say to the people, purify yourselves for tomorrow, and you will have meat to eat, since you have wept in the Lord's hearing, saying, who will give us meat to eat? How happy we were in Egypt, you said. Very well, the Lord will give you meat to eat, and you will eat it not for one day, not for 2 days, not for 5 days, not for 10 days, not for 20 days, but for a whole month, until it comes out of your nostrils and sickens you, since you have rejected the Lord who is among you and wept before him, saying, why did we ever leave Egypt? Is the language clear enough to? Moses says, the people around me number 600,000 foot soldiers, and you say you will give them meat to eat for a whole month? If all the herds and flocks were slaughtered, would that be enough for them? You could almost read for even one day. If all the fish in the seas were collected, would that be enough for them? The Lord said to Moses, this is part of the high point. Part of the high point in chapter 11 is God says, don't let the leader carry the load all alone. Part of my spirit should be on the leaders of the elders of the people, and they should bear the burden with the leader. The second high point here, the Lord said to Moses, this is verse 23. If you underline things, this one is worth underlining. The Lord said to Moses, is the arm of the Lord so short? You will see whether the promise I have made to you comes true or not. And the remainder of this chapter, and maybe a little more, lets this all work out. Now, this is great fun. But the story, the heart of the story is not in the meat. The heart of the story is in these two parts. One is, God says a leader should not bear the load alone. There should be people who are the elders of the people who bear that load with him and who share some of God's spirit so that he doesn't bear it alone. And number two, don't ever think God can't do things that look like they're impossible. Would that the people had remembered this moment a few chapters later. Is the arm of the Lord so short? You will see whether the promise I have made to you comes true or not. The remainder of the chapter All this begins to unfold. Moses went out, told the people what God had said, collected 70 of the people's elders, stationed them around the tent. The Lord descended in a cloud, spoke to him, that's Moses, took some of the spirit that was on him, that's Moses, and put it on the 70 elders. And when the spirit came on them, they prophesied, but only once. I don't know for sure what that means, but whatever powers had been granted to Moses, those powers were granted for a short period to these. How many people were gathered?
70.
Nope.
68.
Because somebody's read another verse. What's the next verse say? Two of them stayed back in the camp. Why did they stay back in the camp? I don't know. The previous verse says he called 70, he gathered 70, he collected 70, he ordered them to be there, but only 60 showed up. Two of them stayed back in the camp. And it doesn't name the 68 who were faithful and showed up. It names the two miscreants who stayed behind. Maybe they had a little bit of beans to finish up from lunch or something, or maybe some of the manna needed to be washed out of the pans. But there they were. He names them. The Spirit came down on them even though they had not gone to the tent. And let me now read that in a different way. The Spirit came down on them, comma, though they had not gone to the tent, their names were enrolled among the rest. And those two began to prophesy in the camp. A young man came running to Moses. Look, he said, these two guys are prophesying in the camp. Joshua, son of Nun, who had served Moses since he was a boy, you get a little clue about Joshua there, spoke up and says, my Lord Moses, stop them. And the next highlight in chapter 11 comes out. All three of these are in this same story. What's Moses' response? Yeah. But what's the heart of the response? Keep going. Would God that all of the people were prophets with the Spirit of God upon them. The whole plan of the Bible is to make that come true. To bring us to the point where all of us have a call and all of us have a portion of God's Spirit resting on us. And you get a glimpse of it first right here. Are you jealous on my account? If only all of God's people were prophets, and if only the Lord had given them all His Spirit. The next day, what happened? The wind picked up, and the wind blew in birds. What kind of birds? Mine says quail. What's the most recent time you've seen a quail? 9 days. Saw a quail 9 days ago. Heard it go Bob White. I saw a quail. How many quail came in?
A bunch.
Starts with W. Way more than lots. They lay for a distance of a day's march either side of the camp. How thick?
3 feet thick
on the ground. That's a lot of quail. The people were up all that day, all that night, and all the next day collecting quails. The least gathered by anyone was 10, maybe it says bushels, I don't know. I know it says homer, but I don't know what that means. I don't have my ancient Egyptian and Israelite weights and measures tables open before me. They then spread them out around the camp. What does that mean? Spread them out around the camp. That's a clue that they're fixing them where they will stay in some edible form. They may be cooking them, they may be salting them, they may be whatever they're doing, they're fixing them. Everywhere you look, you're getting quail jerky getting ready. Here says 60 bushels. Was the least anybody did. Yeah. I don't understand all of verse 33. The meat was still between their teeth, not even chewed, when the Lord's anger was aroused by the people and the Lord struck them with a great plague. And they gave a name to that place. Why? Because it was there that they buried the people who had indulged their greed. And from there they set out. Nothing to eat except this here manna. Chapter 12. That stops the complaining, right?
No.
Not only is it no, who complains now? Aaron and Miriam. What's their complaint?
They don't like Moses' wife.
They don't like Moses' wife, who has not been mentioned once in chapters and chapters and chapters. They mention that it's a Cushite woman, which is Africa, and he had married somebody from Midian, right? It's not clear if they're talking here about a second wife or still talking about the first wife, but somehow they're complaining about it. And verse 2 begins to tell you the heart of what they're talking about. What's their complaint? This is Aaron and Miriam. What's the relationship of Aaron and Miriam to Moses?
Moses.
Who's the oldest brother?
Aaron.
Who's the oldest sister?
Miriam.
How do we know?
She's the only one.
Because she's the one who took him to the riverbank, put him in the river in the ark way back then. This is my little brother. And verse 2 says something that if you realize what they're saying, it has two parts to it. One part is true and one part is ugly. What has God just done? He has taken some of the spirit he put on Moses and put it on 70 elders. And he has shared Moses' burden with those 70, right? And what is their statement? Is Moses the only one through whom the Lord has spoken? Has he not spoken through us too? I don't know how to connect the dots there. What does that have to do with who he's married to? I don't understand it. But somehow the criticism of Moses is something else God gets angry about. He doesn't kill Aaron and he doesn't kill Miriam, but what happens? Miriam contracts leprosy and she ends up with leprosy for 7 days. How is it that the leprosy is finally removed? Aaron intercedes with Moses. Moses intercedes with God. God says the things that she's done, she's got to bear that for a while. But it ends up he bears it for 7 days. And the people did not move, this is verse 15, until she had returned. Now, there's a stopping place here. Because the next high point in the book, I think, is in chapter 13. If you don't do anything else, read chapters 13 and 14 before you come back next time. If you don't do anything else, read chapter 13 and 14. What are the high points we've seen so far? That was a question for you to answer. We've seen number 7, the dedication of the altar. We've seen numbers 11, where we have seen the elders share. We have seen God's arm not too short. And we have seen Moses exclaim, "Would that all God's people, prophets, and spirit-filled." I want to write an abbreviation for numbers, but the only abbreviation I can think of is NUM, and somehow that just doesn't seem like a good abbreviation. Numbers 13, Numbers 14 has the next highlight. I want you to find it, and I want you to look through the rest of the book. See if you can find the places. Remember, some of them may be, as this one will be, 2 chapters long. Some even more than that. Some, like number 11, God's anger's arrived. That's just scattered all across here. And you have to wonder how upset God gets with us. And how his patience and how his anger are worked out in our day. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to that. There are some clues.
He's still doing the same thing. God provides for our needs, not our wants.
Yeah. I think the complaint's about we don't have anything to eat. All we have is manna. We complain more than we joyfully do what he's asked us to do. And the people keep going back and forth between those. Look and see if you can find the other high points. Some of them will be as short as part of a verse. Some will be as short as part of a verse. At least the ones I found will be. But see what happens, okay? Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, we thank you for the time that we have. We thank you for the chance to look into your word. And I pray this morning that some of the high points we're beginning to find will find a home in us, that you really do want us to be your voice in this world. You want us to be filled with your Spirit, not speaking for ourselves, but in our words and in our actions, living out before people the difference that it makes for you to be alive in our hearts. And I pray, Lord, that you would keep us from complaining. In truth, even in the hardest of lives that we might be living, there's relatively little to complain about in comparison to how much we have to celebrate and how much gratitude we have for what you've done for us. All this we pray in your Son's name. Amen.